since my heart's been dying to be saying. Just like a ghost, you've been a haunting my dreams, so I proposed on Halloween. Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little boy like you. Spooky.
And you're still listening to the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, with special guest DJ...
Tricky Walker.
Roger Allen, Halloween 3, the final chapter. What have we been doing today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, Roger Allen?
Been playing Halloween music.
And when I say Halloween 3, it's the third Halloween show you've done on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Thank you.
No problem.
And thank you also for those records, those neat Count Chocula inserted records. So awesome. And CDs as well. And we had Blowfly phoned into the Nardwar Human Servant Radio Show. So we'll all see you tonight, Roger.
At the Blowfly show.
At the
Vancouver,
Blowfly gig happening on Main Street at the Fox Cinema, where you actually saw, what did you see there? Two Live Crew.
I saw Two Live Crew there.
How was that?
It was pretty good, except none of the original members were in the band.
Not one. I thought Fresh Kid Ice was in there.
Luke Skywalker wasn't in it, but Fresh Kid Ice, I have never heard of.
Fresh Kid Ice, the Chinaman. I think he's still in the band.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
he's still in the band. But to you, it's Luke or nothing. But tonight, it's Blowfly.
Blowfly.
For sure, at the Fox Cinema. Doors at 8, show at 9. If you've won tickets, lucky winners. Doors at 8, show at 9. Blowfly, the legendary rapper in house, who wears a mask. That's the tie-in, right?
Halloween.
That's the Halloween tie-in.
Monster Mash.
Monster Mash. There we go. So what did we just hear in that last little set there, Roger Allen?
We started that set with The Damned, with Nasty. I have the record here. I'm showing it. I'm holding it up to the microphone. Recently, the biopic came out, Don't You Wish You Were Dead, which was a Damned biopic. And in 1986, the Vancouver Sun reviewed the Damned album, Anything, and it said it was similar to Simple Minds, and that the record was moody and atmospherical, but not doomy and gloomy.
Uh-oh. Where did you find that out?
Archives. And
you were looking for a Damned review in the Vancouver Sun? That's incredible.
And the website AllMusic, which maybe a lot of people go to listen and read about music, labeled the Damned album as terrible. But the Vancouver Sun said it was very much like the Simple Minds. And then we heard Kid Koala with Trick or Treat featuring Charlie Brown. And I brought along here the Peanuts Book of Pumpkin Carols, which is a strange little book, and it's not
almost looks like
carol.
A bootleg.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of, I suppose. But it's funny. And I also have a tattoo of Charlie Brown on my arm here of the Great Pumpkin.
When did you get that, and where did you get that?
Where? I got that at I got that in Vancouver. And when I got it about, who knows, 6 years ago. And we heard Hot Blood by, or we heard Soul Dracula, Hot Blood, Soul Dracula. We heard Hot Blood by Soul Dracula.
Some disco. You don't discriminate, do you?
No. And that track was in Jim Jarmusch. A lot of hard names to pronounce when I'm bringing these music to whoever's listening. Hot Blood by Soul Dracula. Soul Dracula by Hot Blood. And that was in the Jim Jarmusch vampire film Only Lovers Left Alive. Then we heard Lydia Lunch with her cover of Spooky. And Lydia Lunch recorded on the same record as The Birthday Party, as in on the flip side of a Birthday Party record, there was Lydia Lunch. And The Birthday Party had a record released on Mushroom Records. And in Vancouver, we had a recording studio called Mushroom Records. And Diana Ross, Led Zeppelin, Heart, Queensryche, Loverboy, Sarah McLachlan all recorded there.
And the incredible Bongo Band was recorded there as well.
The cornerstone of hip-hop. Numerous people who have worked at Mushroom Studio claim it's haunted, perhaps by one Shelley Siegel, the man who helped Anne and Nancy Wilson make it big with Dreamboat Annie, which was recorded at Mushroom. Siegel died of a brain aneurysm in his 30s, but many say he still haunts Mushroom Recording Studio, which is now a tech company.
Thank you so much for all these tunes, Roger. We have something else coming up to end the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show. A legendary band, the Alley Cats.
Yes.
Night of the Living Dead.
The Alley Cats with Night of the Living Dead. And also, before everything else, I wanted to mention that Paul Horn also recorded at Mushroom Studios, and Paul Horn had recorded with Lalo Schifrin, and Lalo Schifrin recorded the soundtrack to the film The Exorcist. And finally, as we end the last chapter of Nardwuar's Halloween Spectacular, we're going to end with the Alley Cats and Night of the Living Dead.
That'd be neat if people could trick-or-treat at Mushroom, since The Exorcist was recorded. So The Exorcist was recorded at Mushroom?
I encourage everybody to go to the website Mushroom Studios, which is another term for just a building that has a bunch of websites in it, and ask for candy on Halloween night.
Thank you so much for coming in, Roger Allen, and bringing all these Halloween and Hollywoody type tunes. A whole bunch of records here that you have as well. Any ones you just quickly wanted to mention that you brought in here? The whole bunch of stuff. The Teenage Head?
Teenage Head was very scary for parents. Ghost Town by The Specials. Joy Division. Joy Division is very terrifying because all their music was so frighteningly depressing. Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr. Thunderbird by Quiet Riot.
Oh my God, an original Sonics the Witch 7-inch. Where'd you get this one?
I've had that for a while, and it actually has the singer's name is spelled wrong on that.
Rosalie, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had that for a while. I don't have a complete history on it, but I bought it at a garage sale.
Incredible find. It's worth a lot of money. It was a big hit, too, in Vancouver. I think it went to number 2 or number 1.
Five Man Electrical Band with Werewolf. Face Without a Soul by Status Quo. Ghost Town by The Specials. Girls, Girls, Girls by Motley Crue. Anything by the band Hole. Susie and the Banshees, Drop Dead. Happy Talk by Captain Sensible. The Zombies with You Make Me Feel So Good. Dead End Street by The Kinks. Oh, my gosh.
It's a lot of great Halloween stuff that we didn't get to for next time for Volume 4, Roger.
Volume 4? I don't think... Well, what about this? Anne-Marie was... Susan Jacks with Anne-Marie on Casino Records. Nardwuar, was this recorded at Mushroom Studios?
Probably. I'd imagine so. Although she did some stuff in Nashville. I'm not sure. But still, the Jacks, incredible. 75, maybe not. I'm just guessing that maybe not.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you so much, Roger. Anything else you want to add right now about the Alley Cats we have coming up right here from Los Angeles? There's a great YouTube clip of them as well performing this particular tune.
Alley Cats are a very lesser-known band, and I don't know much about them. So phone in during the news and ask about the Alley Cats.
Well, thanks so much, Roger. Why should people care about Halloween?
Well, Halloween is your only chance to create havoc and destruction.
Well, thanks so much, Roger. Keep on rocking in the free world and do 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 loot do.
Suffering, succotash.
Human blood. Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Shindig CITR's annual band competition is in its 30th year of promoting new local bands and providing great prizes. Shindig happens every Tuesday at Pat's Pub and Brewhouse at 403 East Hastings. So come check out the talent while they compete to win studio time, features in Discorder magazine, buttons, merch, and more. Enjoy locally made beer, pool, and CITR DJ spinning after the bands. Shindig Night 3 is happening this Tuesday, November 3rd, featuring Dried Out, Achuta, and Opposite Shore. Cover is $6 at the door, and the show is 19+. Check out CITR on Facebook or on Twitter at CITR Shindig for all the details.
Every night, over 700 youth sleep on Vancouver's streets. This is their story. Death in a Dumpster, the musical, is a true story about homelessness, written, composed, and performed by a cast of street-involved youth actors. Death in a Dumpster opens November 7th at Waterfront Theatre for 3 performances only. For tickets and information, go to www.deathinadumpster.ca. Death in a Dumpster is presented by Access to Music in association with Directions Youth Services.
Why did you eat the whole thing?
Because
you snuck in my room and got him and shut the door. Because I told you not to eat anymore. Why'd you eat so many?
Because I love M&M's.
I know you love M&M's, but now you're going to have a tummy ache.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
When I have a rumbly in my tummy, the only thing that makes me feel better is listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey there, listeners. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR, and it's a beautiful day in Vancouver here, and hope you're enjoying the weather, and probably sitting at the beach drinking some booze.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, October 30th. I'm Alberto Montilla.
And I'm Linda Yang. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners to our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:15 in the evening and time for a full hour of independent, campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have Segment 1, our Science and Tech Update with Marco.
We also have our weekly financial update with News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman. Then we have two interviews with activists who spoke at City Hall last week about the removal of the Georgia viaducts. The first one is News 101 director Rohit Joseph's interview with Stephanie Allen. Stephanie Allen is who spoke at City Council about the destruction of Hogan's Alley. And
finally, we have the segment interview as segment four, Eva Guansanger's interview with Daniel Zeke, an activist who is skeptical of City Councilor's commitment to creating affordable housing.
But first, some campus headlines for today. In campus news, students to study Game of Thrones in January. A new course at UBC will examine George R.R. Martin's book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, and the popular HBO TV series based on it. UBC Associate English Professor Robert Rouse will be teaching the course and said, quote, "We'll get them to think about and talk about what Martin is doing by reworking these ideas through a very dark modern lens and what that's telling us about our understanding of both the past and the present." The fourth year undergraduate course is titled "Our Modern Medieval, The Song of Ice and Fire as Contemporary Medievalism." Registration for the course reached its 16 student capacity within the first 3 hours after opening in July. The course will examine how civilizations have reimagined the Middle Ages in different ways with Martin's work and the central text. Topics will include women, politics, monsters, disability, nature, history, chivalry, objects, place, religion, sexuality, and race. Students are required to read the 5 books and watch the 5 seasons of the TV series before the course begins. The University of California, Berkeley also offers a first-year film studies course on the Game of Thrones.
In local news, VPD receives new missing person regulations. Currently, officers are able to close cases after receiving confirmation of the phone by concerned parties that the person has been located. BC's new missing persons legislation will go into effect next September. The new legislative change will require police officers to conduct a safe and well check before they close a file. That means police officers will have to check up the missing people who have been found by establishing face-to-face contacts. However, there are concerns about the challenges this may pose to the Vancouver Police Department. VPD Detective Constable Raymond Payne said, quote, "The pending legislative change is in some ways the largest challenge we're going to face in the new year." However, BC's Attorney General Suzanne Anton said police forces should be able to manage this increased workload. According to Payne, 6 officers in Vancouver investigate an average of 12 missing persons a day, and 99.9% of the people reported missing are located. Payne also said the new safe and well check could backfire in cases of high-risk missing people, especially if they have a warrant for a petty crime. Currently, the VPD has a system in place where housing providers can call in missing persons who have been located if they have a warrant for a petty crime. Pat worries about the new regulations. Housing providers will not contact police when a person is found for fear of arrest. The new regulation is a result of a 2012 Missing Women's Commission of Inquiry by Wally Oppel.
In national news, former Toronto Mayor Rob Ford finds new tumor. The city councilor's office released a statement on Wednesday confirming that Ford has a new cancerous tumor growing in his bladder. The controversial politician was recently admitted to Mount Sinai Hospital after suffering from abdominal pains, where tests confirmed the tumor. The news was announced just days after Ford's brother, Doug, told AM640 host Bill Carroll that the ex-mayor had hit a bump in the road with his health. Ford was diagnosed with pleomorphic liposarcoma, a rather rare type of cancer, last fall. He dropped out of Toronto's mayoral race to concentrate on his treatment. After undergoing chemotherapy and other treatments, Ford had surgery in May to remove a cancerous tumor from his abdomen. In an interview held yesterday outside the Toronto hospital, Ford told reporters that he is 99% sure that the tumor is malignant and is awaiting biopsy results. According to CBC, Ford went to tell police reporters that him and his family were caught off guard by the news of his cancer, telling them, "All I can do is fight, and I'll keep fighting until the day I die."
In international news, Guatemala elects comedian in landslide victory. On October 25th, Guatemala held the final round of its presidential election. Jimmy Morales, a former comedian, was elected with nearly 70% of the popular vote. Morales announced his candidacy during a period of massive anti-government demonstrations running with the slogan, "Neither corrupt nor a thief." His platform included goals like the tagging of teachers with a GPS device to ensure they attend classes and give each Guatemalan children a smartphone, as well as limiting the involvement of the military government. Over the last year, Guatemala has been plagued with political scandals reaching the highest levels of the government. In April, a United Nations report linked corruption in the Guatemalan Customs Agency to high-ranking members of the government, including then-president Otto Prasad Molina. Molina, as well as former Vice President Rosagna Baghdati, are currently in jail due to those charges. Prior to running, Morales hosted a comedy talk show in Guatemala with his brother for 15 years. American police officer fired for assaulting students. Video of a South California police officer flipping a black student out of her chair went viral earlier this week. Ben Fields, the officer responsible for the attack, has been fired according to the Richland County Sheriff Leo Lott. The incidents began when a 16-year-old student refused orders from her teacher to put away her cell phone during math class. The student in question was arrested on the controversial charge of disturbing schools. After asking the student to leave the classroom, Fields resorted to use force, grabbing the student's arm and eventually flipping her entire desk onto the ground. According to classmate Nia Kenny, students filmed the incidents on their cell phones because of the officer's reputation. Kenny's attorney Simon Martin said many students referred to Fields as Officer Slam. Sheriff Lott stated that, quote, "This was not a proper technique and should not be used in law enforcement," and that after watching the video, he wanted to throw up. According to the sheriff, Fields has worked as the school's resource officer for the last 7 years and regrets the incident. Fields' attorney Scott Hayes has defended his actions as justified and lawful. The FBI is now looking into whether Fields violated the student's civil rights.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
When Shanna Larson was a little girl, she already had artistic talent, and it was clear that she would be quite an athlete. But Shan always knew what she wanted to do with her life. She wanted to teach. Shan was only 24 years old when she lost her life to breast cancer. And now it's her spirit that will teach us. Teach us to know the symptoms. For more information, visit teamshan.ca. Breast cancer, not just a disease of older women.
Every night, over 700 youth sleep on Vancouver's streets. This is their story. Death in a Dumpster, the musical, is a true story about homelessness written, composed, and performed by a cast of street-involved youth actors. Death in a Dumpster opens November 7th at Waterfront Theatre for 3 performances only. For tickets and information, go to www.deathinadumpster.ca. Death in a Dumpster is presented by Access to Music in association with Directions Youth Services.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, segment one, our science and tech update with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco. According to some people, Halloween is a time to have fun, but to others, it's a time to be afraid. But NASA is now telling us there is no need to fear A2015 TB145. What is this? It's a 400-meter class near-Earth object or asteroid that will pass safely by Earth tomorrow on Halloween, about from 1 o'clock to 5 p.m. Pacific time. Using the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Horizon web application, hosted by NASA and JPL, they numerically computed the accurate trajectory of asteroid 2015 TB145, and it will safely pass by Earth, but it will come within 500,000 kilometers closest approach. The asteroid was first spotted on June 10th by astronomers in Hawaii and later confirmed with European telescope. It will be closer than 500,000 kilometers, but the sky will still be rather bright, so it will be difficult to see. The asteroid will be located in the sky towards the north-northwest, and it is quite faint, and as it moves away, it will be fainter. But you can see it with a telescope if you have a good eye and sense where it is. The asteroid, though, will only be visible at a 20 degrees angle, so it might not be seen very well. It cannot be seen by the naked eye. But it should be very safe, and it will miss Earth. In our second story, a Canadian story, researchers from the University of Alberta have tested potato byproducts and turned them into eco-friendly plastic films. Potato skins from the Alberta's potato processing industry have been used by researchers from the University of Alberta to create a starch-based film, which is both eco-friendly, rich in antioxidants, and rich in antimicrobial agents as well, which makes it longer shelf life. Professor and of Engineering Marley Arando from the Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutritional Science says the development of antioxidant and antimicrobial films can improve product shelf life and safety. This has applications for both food processing industry and the cosmetic industry. The potato skin whey replaces traditional petroleum-based plastic products. The potato peels are highly phenolic, which means they have natural compounds that are produced in plants for protection. These phenolic compounds are also found in apple peels and grape peels. The team of researchers use subcritical fluid technology to extract the phenol compounds from the potato. With traditional methods of using methanol, this is a much more toxic solvent. But when they use the water subcritical fluid method, it can then modify the starch, and it will not harm the environment. It will also increase the tensile strength, the elongation, and the antioxidant properties of the films. They have already applied for an international patent, so this might come to market soon. Another researcher is also adding nanoparticles to the films to make them more antioxidant and more strong. In another story, ozone hole over Antarctica hits record size, but the World Meteorological Organization says there's no reason for undue alarm. The UN's Weather and Climate Agency says that the hole is a record size this month, and ozone shields life on Earth from the sun. The Montreal Protocol for the Environment was passed in the 70s, but the chemicals that were banned will still linger in the environment for a few more years. So the World Meteorological Association sees the ozone hole getting smaller because the fluorocarbons take time to diminish. So we are looking forward by 2025 to have a bigger ozone hole in our environment. This is Marco. You listen to the Science News.
Thank you, Marco. Now we have our weekly financial update with News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
These are this week's top stories. Volkswagen's woes continue. Twitter shares plunge 11% on weaker user base growth. China scraps a one-child policy and allows two children. Trouble for Valiant Pharmaceuticals continues. And Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment gets a new CEO. We begin today's news with Volkswagen having posting its first quarterly loss in the last 15 years on Wednesday. They said that $7.4 billion set aside to cover the cost of its rigged diesel emissions tests was likely just the start. Almost 6 weeks after admitting using illegal software to cheat U.S. diesel emissions tests, Europe's biggest car maker is under pressure to identify those responsible and fix up to 11 million affected vehicles and convince regulators it won't make the same mistake again. This is the biggest business crisis in its 78-year history and has wiped out a quarter of Volkswagen's stock market value and has forced out its longtime CEO. Volkswagen reported a loss of $1.83 billion U.S. in its third quarter. New CEO Matthew McClure said Wednesday that the cost of the scandal would be enormous but manageable, without giving too much details. The stock is up today, closing at $27.80 with a 0.49% gain for the day. Shares are down once again for the social media giant Twitter. Twitter sales and profits are up, but shares plunged 11% on user growth numbers. Twitter has 320 million active monthly users, which is up from 316 million in the previous quarter, but were below market estimates. The social networking site reported revenues of $565 million, up 58% from the $361 million during the same period last year. However, lackluster user growth and disappointing outlook for the rest of the year caused shares to plummet more than 11% after hours and by more than 20% in the past 12 months. This is Twitter's first earnings report since co-founder Jack Dorsey regained his position as the CEO on October 5, 2015. In order to reduce costs, Twitter cut ties with 8% of its workforce, laying off 336 people on October 13th. Shares of Twitter closed today at $28.46 for a loss of 2.06%. There is historical news coming out of East Asia. China will ease the family planning restrictions to allow all couples to have two children after decades of a strict one-child policy. The ruling Communist Party said on Thursday the move was aimed to reduce demographic strains on the economy. After a growing number of scholars and economists have argued that the government should reform the rules, introduced in the late 1970s to prevent population growth spiraling out of control, but now regard the policy as being outdated and responsible for the shrinking China's labor pool. For the first time in decades, the working-age population fell in 2012. The announcement was made during a closed statement at a key party meeting focused on financial matters on Thursday. Officials noted concern of the country's slowing economy and aging population as the reason. There is no immediate details on the new policy or time frame for implementation. More scandal for the Canadian-based pharmaceutical giant, Valeant Pharmaceuticals. During a press release this morning, Valeant Pharmaceuticals reported that it will be cutting ties with Philidor Rx Services, a partner company at the center of a controversy. Valeant also stated that the business will be shutting down after Bloomberg first reported news that Philidor was using negative practices on Thursday. The Laval, Quebec-based company lost almost $10 billion in market value since the news broke on October 21st, which suggested that Valeant Pharmaceuticals was using Philidor to artificially pump up retail sales and engage in Enron-style accounting tactics. Valeant Pharmaceuticals has denied these allegations. Philidor Rx Services counts for 6.8% of Valeant's total revenue in the third quarter of this year. Valeant Pharmaceuticals stock closed today at $122.04 for a loss of 17.7%. The company's stock value has lost 64% of its value since August 5, 2015. There's a new sheriff in town, and his name is Freesdale. After 14 months of searching, Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment has found a new chief executive officer, naming former Air Canada executive Michael Freesdale as the organization's next leader. Michael Freesdale comes from Air Canada's Leisure Group, which combines the airline's vacation and discount brands, where he's been at the helm since 2012. He's previously held executive roles with the travel service Thomas Cook Group PLC. Quote, "These are very exciting times for Toronto, indeed for all Canadian sports fans. I am very proud to lead the MLS team and will deliver for them," Mr. Freesdale said in a statement. The role is now expected to focus more on sales, tickets, and marketing, as well as the firm's real estate holdings, leaving the day-to-day operations and sports franchises to the Maple Leafs president Brendan Shanahan and Toronto Raptors president and general manager Masir Jiri. In other market news, Toronto's S&P-TSX Composite Index fell 1.9% to close at 13,529. The broader S&P 500 index stayed relatively flat today, posting a loss of 0.48% on the day to close at 2,972. The Nasdaq closed lower with a loss of 0.4%. In the European markets, the German DAX closed up 0.09%. In the Asian indices, markets stayed relatively flat as the Japanese Nikkei posted a gain of 0.78%, while the Shanghai Composite lost 0.14%. In the commodities market, December gold futures closed down 0.51% to close at $1,141 an ounce, while the December crude futures were up 0.83% to close at $46.46 an ounce. In natural gas, December future contracts were up 0.67% to close at $2.32. Turning to the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.532%, while U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower today at rates at 2.1439%.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here, right here on News 101.
Right Honorable W.L. Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, speaking from Ottawa.
There is no home in Canada, no family, and no individual whose fortunes and freedom are not bound up in the present struggle.
This Remembrance Day, CITR presents At Home and Overseas. More than two dozen Vancouver actors recreate the personal stories of those who experienced firsthand what life was like in Canada during the Second World War. Wednesday, November 11th, from 6:30 to 8 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. Or look for the podcast at citr.ca.
You're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried line. Have you any dirty washing, mother dear? We're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried line, 'cause the washing day is here. Whether the weather may be wet or fine, we'll just rub along.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASA UBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have News 101 Director Rohit Joseph's interview with Stephanie Allen.
My name is Stephanie Allen. I am a grad student at SFU's Urban Studies program, and I also work in the development of housing.
All right, great. Thank you, Stephanie. What can you tell us and the listeners of CITR about Hogan's Alley?
So Hogan's Alley was a community that formed over time. Late 1800s and early 1900s, black settlers kind of moved into the Vancouver area and gathered in this area of Strathcona. Strathcona at the time had been a predominantly immigrant community with folks from all over Europe and Asia settling in the area. It was a place of affordable housing. And for the black community, it served as a close proximity to the railroads where a lot of the men who lived in the area worked. A lot of them were porters on the trains. So it was a community that kind of provided a bit of a haven because it was ethnically diverse, and it provided affordable housing and access to jobs.
What ended up happening to this community? Because a lot of Vancouverites may not have heard of Hogan's Alley. So what actually happened?
Yeah, and I hadn't heard of Hogan's Alley, actually, until I really started digging into the research. So it became a pretty thriving community there in this corner of Strathcona. There were a number of housing developments where their folks lived in rental apartments. There were a number of homeowners. There were also businesses there, different eateries and places where folks would not only find food and to eat, but also communal kinds of spaces. There was actually such a strong black presence that they had gotten together and bought a church that still remains into this place. But it was really, you know, the kind of urban renewal program that launched what became the destruction of this black neighborhood. Under the government program, there was infrastructure dollars available to municipalities who were interested in upgrading infrastructure and redeveloping their downtown areas.
And when was this around? When was this taking place?
So this kind of started building in the 19... So it was under the National... I believe it was under the National Act, National Urban Housing Act of 1956. And what it required was that municipalities provide research and findings to basically map out where they wanted this redevelopment and renewal effort to take place, and then they could apply for funds. And so in Vancouver, the city published the 1957 redevelopment study, and the study basically was to map out what they defined as blight or conditions that had fallen into severe disrepair in both public public and private spaces. Ironically enough, it was assessed that Hogan's Alley had demonstrated some of the most urgent and severe cases of blight, and that it was slated or kind of put on the list for immediate redevelopment activities. It's important to note that the city also in this document acknowledged that they were leaving this area of Vancouver to fall into disrepair. They were not spending money on roads, sidewalks, infrastructure upkeep. It was clear that the area was being neglected, and the message being sent to residents was this is not a place that the city either A, had as a priority, but also B, there was this threat of eminent domain and that the area would be bought up and redeveloped by the city. So folks were living in a very tentative situation. They had, you know, the whispers that this place was going to be redeveloped and that they would be displaced into other areas of the city.
So what was the impact of Hogan's Alley's destruction on Vancouver's Black community?
Well, this is something that they had foresight of. In the redevelopment study of 1957, it's actually documented, and I read that in the council chambers, that they understood that this was a significant portion of the Black population and that disruption would cause harm. They called it special problems. They went on to describe how it would disrupt social networks. And they even said that care should be taken to prevent future ethnic enclaves from forming in the city. I mean, this is in their own documented words. And they did just that, really. They went in, and I personally haven't found a lot of the records. I know other scholars have. Wayne Compton said he had found some of the artifacts in the city archives that documented the eminent domain that the city enacted to force property owners to go. But folks had started to move out. They saw that the writing was on the wall. And the dispersal basically occurred just as predicted. The community there of Black churchgoers had to sell their church because they had lost members. And essentially, the community was completely gone. By the 1970s, there were no traces of this former thriving community.
Are the descendants of Hogan's Alley still in Vancouver, but like dispersed all over, or they have a lot of them left the city entirely?
That's a great question, and one I don't know the answer to exactly. I know that there has been some documentary effort to capture voices and to capture the stories of the folks who live there. And I have attended the City of Vancouver's Black History Month celebration. Well, I guess it was in 2013 when also the federal government recognized Hogan's Alley and another similar community that was displaced in Halifax, Africville. And there were, it seemed, a few folks there who I believe had been former residents and their descendants. So it seems like there are people in the area that that there are descendants that do live still in proximity to Vancouver or in the metro region, and that could be accessed for what I'm proposing, which is really a consultation with former residents, their descendants, and the greater Black community to talk about how the city can recognize, not only through memorialization, which I think is important, but also through spatial considerations or restorative justice measures, really look at how their actions impacted this community and talk about what can be done moving forward.
How did you feel stepping into City Hall when you were about to give this speech? Was this your first time ever doing something like that? And what was your feelings going into it?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, it wasn't my first time ever formally speaking as a citizen to City Council. In the course of my work in real estate development, I have spoken to City Councils in the past, but as a part of my job function. But never as a citizen. And, you know, frankly, I found myself quite nervous. It's a very imposing structure. And to speak in that space, and especially to talk about something that is about marginalized communities and to talk about justice, it's an intimidating process. And it's funny because public hearings are an important part of municipal democracy, but it is also a very intimidating process. And I can imagine how folks would feel getting up there and not wanting to speak like that and talk in that capacity. But, you know, I can understand how this is an important venue also to do that. So I just that nuance of speaking to council in a structure, in a setting like that, you know, where the room is predominantly, you know, 90% of the room you can kind of feel is the structure is the mayor and council and administrative staff. And there's a very small portion of it that is for the public. So even in the physical layout of the room, it has a very imposing kind of feeling. It really doesn't feel like it's in favor of the citizen, right? It's an interesting dynamic there.
How did you feel the reception was from the city councillors? Did you feel like your voice was genuinely heard?
Speaking, you know, only on my behalf, and I don't know what the experience would be like for others, but I did feel engaged. I did feel, and I was sure to make eye contact with the councillors as I was speaking and to look up. Which is, I know, very difficult to do. And I found their follow-up questions were really revealing in a lot of ways, but showed that they were listening, because they asked me, what is the path forward? What am I actually asking for? You know, you can hear that echoed in quite a few of the statements. And so I felt that they had, acknowledged what I said. I think there was a desire to really understand what's being asked for, because if I had gone, or anyone had gone up there and simply said, you know, this happened, it leaves a bit of a void. Well, what do we do? You know, and I think it's important for members of the community who do speak to council to really make it clear what they want to see happen, how they want council to act on their behalf. And so I felt like it overall that it was positive. I felt good about the kind of questions I was asked and the chance to give further explanation into the things that I'm proposing. So I felt it was good.
And speaking of the community, there seemed to be a pretty strong presence from Vancouver's Black community in City Hall last Tuesday, or Wednesday, sorry. And at least judging from Wade Compton, the Simon Fraser professor and writer, and Daniel Sige, another writer slash journalist and activist, they were also lending their voices. Why is it that you think this issue has, it still has this prominence, this strength to this day?
I think because, and I think the reason why it's a touch point for many in the Black community is because we can kind of see how much racially motivated decisions that have come from authorities, governments, can have such a lasting negative impact. We look across North America and we see history and we see the contemporary and how things have changed, but yet how much marginalization, oppression, and injustice still perpetuates. And it's becoming intolerable, I think, for communities to continue to see injustice perpetrated over and over again. As much as the Black Lives Matter movement is gaining great political traction in the United States, I can see how Black Lives Matter and that whole philosophy is an aspect of this story also. And I think it's very difficult for people in Vancouver, Black communities in Vancouver who have lived elsewhere, when we move here and come and see that this is a very underrepresented Black urban presence in this city, unlike many other cities in Canada and across North America, we ask why. And when we ask why, it leads us to the story of Hogan's Alley. And when we see what happened, it's very frustrating. It's very angering. It leads people like myself to want to see some kind of acknowledgement and action, especially as a decision like this looms over city council with the, you know, prospect of removing the viaduct. That prospect creates an opportunity. And so for me, as a person who looking through the lens of urban planning and in land use, I think to myself, what a great opportunity to address these past wrongs through a spatial and place-making process.
What would you like to see? And you could think as big, you know, pie in the sky as you like. What would be your ideal engagement from City Hall, from City Council on this issue? What would you like to see them do? And if you could have it your way.
So my pie in the sky, it would look like housing. It would look like economic opportunities. It would look like community gathering spaces for arts, for culture, for different celebrations and public events. You know, it would look like the opportunity to create those social networks again, those bonds, and to have a presence in Vancouver that was willfully taken away.
Thank you. That's a great answer. And lastly, I just wanted your take on what you've seen from the mainstream media in terms of coverage on, or lack of coverage on this issue of Hogan's Alley and the Georgia Viaducts.
That's a great question. And I found that there was coverage by some outlets, you know, within the first couple paragraphs of reporting. And I found other outlets didn't even acknowledge it. And that was very frustrating because I, you know, we know that media spotlight on an issue can really do a lot to put political pressure and to put responsibility onto the lap of our leadership. And so I saw that as a disappointing kind of outcome from certain news outlets. But at the same time, I think that, you know, speaking to folks like you who are involved in journalistic expressions and media that is trying to bring alternative stories and alternative voices forward, you know, this is the power that kind of our new technology and our new opportunities create. So I think that's really positive.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and inform us, Stephanie. What can we look forward to regarding this regarding this issue and your presence with it? Is this something you're, after the decision is made, you're going to still be active on and we can follow you and the progress?
I would like to stay involved. I plan to. If I'm asked to participate by the city, I will. And I think keeping the pressure on this topic, not only as a, you know, let's bring forward justice, but also as a really cool and interesting and nuanced story about our city's history. So, you know, it's something that we should celebrate also.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephanie. It's been a pleasure to talk to you on behalf of CITR News 101. I thank you.
Thank you so much, Rohit. You take care.
For our final segment, for our final story of the evening, we have Eva Ugin-Senge's interview with Daniel Senghe.
I am a resident of Vancouver. I am African of Eritrean descent. And although my ancestors did not live in Hogan's Alley, I feel a certain affiliation with that story and that whole process because it is something that all Black people or all racialized people in a lot of different areas within North America have experienced.
So as you know, council voted Tuesday to proceed with the plan to tear down the viaducts. Last week when you spoke to councillors, you said that if this happened, the city would be making the same mistake again. What's your main concern with the project going forward?
So I wasn't focusing on the tearing down of the viaduct itself. I actually think removing the viaduct is probably a great idea, especially if the city actually built real affordable housing. My concern is that the city is very unlikely to build affordable housing. It looks like, according to the city report, they will be building market housing, condos. The land is owned by a few different developers. In light of their new definitions of affordability, it looks like a lot of the people who live in that area, Chinatown is adjacent to it, just won't be able to afford to live there. So the mistake that they're repeating is that they displaced Black people from Hogan's Alley because that land is valuable. They were facilitating development, helping out developers in that area. And it looks like they're doing the exact same thing today.
Okay. Could you explain how you would describe truly affordable housing?
I think it should be tied to welfare rates and old age pension. That's something that Carnegie Community Action Project describes in pretty good detail. At the moment, like, market housing is definitely not affordable for people in that area. And affordability, I don't know the exact numbers, but the new definitions of affordability from the city are above welfare rates. and pretty unaffordable for a lot of working class people.
When you spoke about the history of Hogan's Alley, you were talking about the efforts that were made to portray the neighborhood as a slum and use that as a reason to make way for building the viaducts. What connections do you see between these kinds of urban renewal or gentrification projects and the marginalization of minority groups?
Right. Yeah, a deep connection. As I said there was a real concerted effort to depict it as a slum. It was not a slum. They were doing the same thing with Chinatown. The reality was that even areas that were remotely slum-like were like that because the city made that effort or withheld funding or whatever it might be. So there was an amplifying of every unfortunate circumstance or maybe criminal activity that might have happened in Hogan's Alley, amplified in the media or in city reports. And it kind of created this narrative that, hey, these are people who don't deserve much, and they deserve to be displaced if we consider their land valuable. And yeah, we are seeing echoes of that today. There's, 2 years ago, there was suddenly a so-called mental health crisis in the downtown East Side. And that was used to legitimize displacing people and putting them into institutions, or legitimizing this concept or this belief that the people there are troubled and they're not doing much with that area anyways. We might as well displace them and use that land for better uses, quote unquote better.
Yeah, you mentioned Chinatown. There was an article in the Georgia Strait where the former chair of the Vancouver Chinatown Revitalization Committee spoke and said there's big potential for the revitalization of Chinatown with the project for tearing down the viaducts going forward because it kind of chopped up Chinatown before. What's your response to that?
I think there is a lot to that. As I said, I actually am in favor of removing the viaducts, connecting these different parts of the city, and ideally building truly affordable housing. I don't know that person's position. Revitalization is one of those buzzwords that's usually used to mean condo development. So I'm kind of apprehensive about that right now. But in its core, like just based on what you said, that's a great idea. But what really matters is how affordable the housing there is, and whether it really does create a situation where people can remain where they live. Because, gentrification means that when condos go up and high-end restaurants and cafes and whatnot built in that area, prices everywhere or prices nearby go up too. So if people in Chinatown, many of them elderly, just can't afford to live where they are and where they'd rather be, then to me that doesn't really sound like true revitalization.
Stephanie Allen,
Unfortunately, we've run out of time for the whole segment, so just check out our SoundCloud if you want to hear the rest of that.
And that's our program for today, October 30th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or